Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Stanton in for Ben Kiefer on this Politics Wednesday today. With us for the hour, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science and department chair at Drake University. Dennis, thanks for being here.
Good afternoon.
And Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Glad you can be with us today.
Hey there.
Well, let's start off with China and tariffs. So for a long time, we've heard President Trump criticizing China for the trade practices. In March, he announced tariffs on steel and aluminum. China responded with tariffs on pork and fruit coming into China from the U.S. This week, Trump announced more tariffs on Chinese goods. He outlined a 25% tariff on mostly high-tech goods, saying that China's been involved in cyber theft and unfair trade. And now China has again responded, proposing tariffs on soybeans, sorghum, beef, cars, and other products. It's important to say that both Trump's proposals and the Chinese responses are not yet in effect. We'll know in a month or so, perhaps. But soybean futures have dropped, and nearly 30% of all soybeans grown in the U.S. go to China. Iowa is the second leading producer of soybeans behind Illinois. And the president of the Iowa Soybean Association, Grant Kimberly, spoke with NPR's David Green this morning about the potential impact of the tariffs.
If they do go into effect and this remains long term, this could be devastating to not only, you know, farmers like myself, but also to farmers all over the United States. There's been projections that have said that, you know, if there was a tariff around the range that they're projecting, which would be a 25% tariff, our exports would probably drop by around 70% in total. And then that would also dramatically reduce our production. Our production would probably go down, and it would just, you know, retaliate and spiral downwards to lower prices for all farmers. And some farmers might have to file bankruptcy, you know, if it goes on too long.
Well, in a post to Twitter this morning, the president says this is not a trade war because the U.S. is already at such a disadvantage. He said this: "We are not in a trade war with China. That war was lost many years ago by the foolish or incompetent people who represented the U.S., the president wrote. And now we have a trade deficit of $500 billion a year with intellectual property theft of another $300 billion. We cannot let this continue," the president said. And in a later tweet, "When you're already $500 billion down, you can't lose. You can't lose." Dennis Goldford.
Well, different folks, different occupations tend to lose in a national and certainly a globalized market. I'm not an economist, but I think that here's a case in which the president goes against what's been Republican orthodoxy for a long, long time. Republicans have always been free traders, the argument being that the market will decide the best allocation of resources. And going back to the classical economist David Ricardo, who developed the theory of comparative advantage, you let countries with a particular knack for producing certain kinds of goods and services efficiently and at least cost, you sort of surrender that business to them while you focus on businesses and operations where you have this comparative advantage, where you produce goods most efficiently at the lowest cost. But it takes the world, as it were, it takes a global perspective on the nature of a market. And a lot of this theory developed out of a reaction against mercantilism, in which a country simply tries to stack up its own chips and sees any kind of deficit as in some way losing the trade game. Well, the president comes across as a kind of neo-mercantilist in this regard, upsetting quite a few Republicans, although ironically gaining the support of some Rust Belt Democratic representatives and senators who want tariffs of this sort to protect their particular workers. So the story is a situation in which the president sees it as his mission to protect the jobs of people in these traditional manufacturing industries, steel, coal, things like that. And of course, they were very important in Pennsylvania, Michigan, places like that, West Virginia. So he's acting on a campaign promise. But at the same time, if the figures I've seen are accurate, you may save jobs in the tens of thousands in those extractive industries, but that may cost you jobs in the hundreds of thousands because you You may support a job from someone in the steelmaking business. You raise the price of steel, but that hurts the job from someone, say, in the auto industry, where they use steel to make their own cars and vehicles, and they have to pass those costs on to consumers. So the president has a particular view about how world trade functions. I would suggest that sometimes urban preconceptions to the contrary, farmers know very well how world trade operates, and that's why they know this is a threat to their global markets in retaliatory terms.
Tim Hagel.
Yeah, to follow up on Dennis's first point, it's some people would argue that, and I suppose Trump would be one of them, that for many years the United States has been hurt by Chinese policies. It's not exactly a free market as far as China policy is concerned. And so he's basically taking action, particularly with tech things, copyright interests, and as manufacturing and so forth, as was mentioned. But the problem is, and this is the point Dennis, I think, was making initially, is that now we've got different people being hurt. And for Iowa, we care about the agricultural side of thing and the manufacturing side of things, because, of course, some of the manufacturers, John Deere and others that manufacture products for agriculture, also becomes a problem if the agricultural things, soybeans, pork, and so forth, are going to have tariffs imposed on them. And so it's a matter of who's going to be hurt. I suppose the saving grace here maybe is that it's something like 60 days, I think I saw the date of May 22nd, before these would actually take effect. So there's a certain amount of time before anything happens. Now, of course, that's already affecting the futures markets, but in terms of direct effect, there's time to negotiate. And one of the things about Trump is that he does these sorts of things as sort of a negotiating tactic. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It certainly makes people unhappy, and it can roil up the markets, stock markets, but also the specific markets, agricultural futures and so forth. That's not necessarily a good thing, but it's also not set in stone at this point. We can hope that this is just a tactic, and China and U.S. can come together and find some reasonable accommodation.
It's a kind of economic brinksmanship. And again, it may be effective, as Tim says. The president evidently did this sort of thing in the real estate business. And there clearly is. There's no question about the problem of intellectual property theft and technology transfers on the part of China. But again, as Tim said, there are winners and losers here. And in Iowa, there may be more losers between John Deere and people who farm for a living. In effect, these folks, if these tariffs go through, these folks will, in effect, be writing a personal check to be sent to steel workers in Pennsylvania.
You're listening to River on Iowa Public Radio News. Dennis Goldford and Tim Hagel with us for the hour. We want to hear from listeners also. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. Are you someone that might be affected by these tariffs, perhaps? A number of things that, again, potentially could be affected, but there is some time before they would go into effect. But this issue is one among many, but if it does go through and farmers are affected, well, does that end up sparking some Trump skepticism in the Midwest? Again, it's one issue of many, but could that have political fallout among Trump's base? Tim Hagel.
Well, I think it probably could. That certainly one of the things that we've seen before is that a lot of people, and particularly independents, will tend to vote pocketbook issues. And we've seen this, 25, 30 years, people talked about, remember the Clinton campaign, it's the economy, stupid, and you've got to understand that pocketbook thing. And a lot of people, and we saw this effectively in the 2016 presidential election, where people were concerned about jobs and the economy and were sort of putting aside a lot of the political side of things. And that's going to happen again. Now, how much it's going to affect the 2018 midterm elections, that's something a lot of people obviously are talking about because they're now creeping up on us here, getting into primary season. But, how much Trump policy affects what goes on in the midterms is hard to say. You've started to see where not only some Democrats, but some Republican representatives are distancing themselves from this. I saw Representative Young tweeted out something, I think it was today, it might have been a retweet from yesterday, basically saying, look, this kind of a potential trade war with China is not good for Iowa. And that's obvious. I mean, he's got to protect his constituents. And so you start to see those sorts of things that will allow those candidates, whether they're incumbents or not, to distance themselves from Trump policy. We'll have to see if it continues and if it actually goes into effect, then it may be more of an effect for the midterms, but potentially long term in the 2020 presidency. presidential race.
And the midterms do seem like several political lifetimes away, but we do like to talk about them when we are getting into, as you say, primary season. But Dennis Goldford, any way that might play out this year?
Well, there's always the possibility. Oftentimes, or usually, midterms are seen as a kind of referendum on the current administration, although increasingly over the past decade or two, our politics has become much more nationalized. I mean, midterms are essentially local elections at the state and congressional district level, not to mention state legislative offices and state executive offices. But our elections have become increasingly nationalized. I mean, 2010 was a basic referendum on President Obama and the Affordable Care Act to the disastrous effects on the part of the that administration. And Republicans are indeed concerned about the extent to which these midterms will be a referendum on the Trump victory, let alone the Trump administration, the Trump victory in 2016. But when we talk about these pocketbook issues, we have to remember that what we normally mean by the Trump movement or the populism of the Trump movement is not purely pocketbook. To be sure, it's a matter of people who feel left behind by the pace of economic development, the concentration of wealth-producing areas in on the coast, if you will. I mean, wasn't there a figure that the counties that supported Hillary Clinton accounted for something like 2/3 of the gross domestic product, whereas the counties that supported President Trump, you know, the vast, overwhelming majority, accounted for only about 1/3 of the gross domestic product. So there's that economic dimension, but to a great extent, we have to remember the Trump base is cultural as well as purely economic. And on the one hand, you might have supported Donald Trump because you believe he spoke for you against people who called you deplorables, against people who you regard as Washington elites. That's cultural rather than economic per se. And the interesting question will be, what happens when your cultural the side of you and your cultural concerns may conflict with your pocketbook concerns? That's what we don't know yet.
And before we move on from the back and forth with trade with China, we do have this apparently 30 days or so before something might happen. During that time, if the president ends up negotiating something, maybe we have a little back and forth. Maybe things get worked out, and maybe it could turn out, you know, hypothetically, that U.S. gets a better deal. I mean, I guess that would be the stated goal of Trump's action. So, what if that happened? Would the president get credit for that, Tim Hagel?
Well, I think he probably would. It would depend, obviously, on what the specifics of the deal were, and as we were saying before, that you know some areas of the U.S. Markets are helped and some are hurt for any particular deal that's made. And as Dennis was pointing out earlier, that you know maybe the tariffs initially are going to help save some jobs in manufacturing areas in some of the states, Pennsylvania and Michigan and West Virginia, you mentioned, at the expense of maybe the agricultural jobs, if that's the way it happens. Well, if that goes through, then it maybe has some sort of mixed result. But I think that if there is a deal and if there's something that, and this is the if the administration can sell it as a win in some way, then that maybe does help them or at least takes that particular issue off the table as a negative. But again, we just have to wait and see.
Dennis Goldsford.
Well, I would just say this may work out for the direction the president wants it to go. It's not certain yet. But when I referred to brinksmanship, again, I just think in terms of people who are in retirement or getting close to retirement and whose retirement income is based, of course, partially on a bit from Social Security, but mostly on 401ks, things like that. These folks are not enjoying looking at the stock market results every day. There's a lot of value erased from the stock market. And the president, of course, took great credit for the rise in the stock market since the election. He hasn't quite said anything about the decline in the stock market recently.
Right. And that's always tends to be a danger when you tie something of your own policies to something that may or may not be really within in your control.
That's right. That's right. And we're just in a period of tremendous uncertainty across a wide range of aspects of American life. And that's what got people very uncomfortable, if not fearful.
Okay. You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio News, and we're going to move on to the U.S. Census Bureau announcing in the year, in the 2020 census, will be asking respondents whether they are U.S. citizens. Well, that sparked concern that there are political motivations behind that move. Now, Iowa is one of 17 states suing the Trump administration, hoping to block that question from appearing on the census questionnaire. And Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller says, in his words, it would depress census participation in communities with large immigrant populations, threatening billions of dollars in critical federal funds for education, infrastructure, Medicaid, and more. And he said he believes, again, in his words, everyone should be counted, adding a citizenship question would undermine participation and accuracy. And that echoed the sentiments of New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, another plaintiff.
It is important to realize that to get an accurate account of our communities, the census has to send people door to door to get responses from those who haven't submitted their forms. The prospect of someone saying, I am from the Trump administration, knocking on your door to ask a question about citizenship would understandably provoke real fear. This is not just a matter of trying to be accommodating or not accommodating to immigrants. The Constitution requires us to count everybody.
And we should say also California has a separate lawsuit in the same matter. Dennis Goldford, is it political?
Well, you know, of course it's political. The concern about who's in the country legally and legitimately has been a concern for quite a number of years, even before the Trump campaign originated as an idea in his mind that he wanted to run for president. So people have been concerned about immigration, whether legal or certainly illegal, for quite some time. Now, there's an argument on the Republican side that illegal immigrants have been doing a lot of mischief, not to mention crime, but certainly, which is always a question for, you know, regarding everybody. Whether you're a citizen or not, committing crime. But there is the question about whether, in fact, illegals have voted. And Republicans have gotten a lot of mileage out of that, even when the data suggests that and the sources suggest that's almost not an issue at all, or at least a very, very small one with regard to elections. But we have to remember that there are parts of the Constitution, and I meant to check this before I came over to the studio, and I'm furiously of flying through my cell phone version of the Constitution at the moment to find it. There's certainly areas of the Constitution that refer to citizens of the United States, but there are other areas of the Constitution that refer simply to persons. And that's regardless of whether you're a citizen or not. You know, famously, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution establishes a criterion for citizenship, but it also famously says, you know, as reference to a privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, but then the Due Process Clause says that no state shall, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor to deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. So that speaks broader than simply just to citizens, because we find that distinction in that amendment itself. And the idea behind the census is that all persons are supposed to be counted, not simply citizens.
Yeah, I wonder if that's the perception of the American public as far as how they view what the Census Bureau is meant to do.
Well, I'm not sure what the American public knows about that. There are lots of technical things in the Constitution that I've not paid attention to in great detail. There's simply reference to an enumeration. I'm looking at part of this was changed by the abolition of slavery, of course, but the original passage says, which I finally found, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and then raising the issue of slaves, which thankfully is not an issue anymore. But the reference is to persons. It's not to citizens. And the concern about this, the possible citizenship question, of course, is that it may make some people, even if they are citizens, but also others, more reticent to come forward and be counted. And that has an impact on the kind of federal aid that a particular state might get, as well as a number of other things.
That's true. And Tim Hagel, at the same way, though, asking a question, it does sound simple, doesn't it, to ask simply, are you a U.S. citizen or not? But is there more to it than that?
There is and there isn't. There is in the sense that, the original question is this political? And the short answer is obviously, yes, it is, in terms of the lawsuits and the opposition to it and so forth. And at the practical level, and Dennis was getting to this there at the end, in the terms of the amount of aid, federal aid. And so it's based often on population. And so particularly cities or states or counties that have a large population or a large number of people who are not here legally, that it can affect their aid, and it's a drain on their resources, either in terms of education or whatever other support services that these folks would need that maybe they aren't necessarily paying taxes for because of the way they're functioning in the economy in some sort of under the radar type of way. And so because of that, these places are certainly unhappy with this particular question. Now, in terms of anybody that's here legally, the question of citizenship shouldn't affect that. So it's really a matter of anybody that's here illegal that may not come forward. And as thinking about this morning, that you also have the question of representation, that some of the states that have larger populations of people that are not here legally are also ones that are growing. I think of Texas in particular. I'm not sure. California, I think, is still growing, but certainly is the largest state that they, in terms of representation, maybe that would affect what they're going to be. And we know, of course, that after the census that we have a redistricting that goes on, and some states lose and some states gain representatives in Congress. And certainly that's particularly important as well, aside from the actual money that the members of Congress vote.
Right, and something that's happened in Iowa in recent memory, that's the congressional...
Losing a congressional seat. Now, we shouldn't be on the hook for losing one this time around, but probably after the 2030 census, we might be again.
And the larger picture of immigration, we're going to continue in just a minute. We're going to be taking a break, and we'll carry on with immigration. But briefly, Dennis Goldford, what might come of this Census Bureau? I know we don't know what the lawsuit will play out, but again, politically, would there really be any risk for the Trump administration to be pushing something like this?
Well, they tend to push things whether there's a risk or not because of their – somebody once said, whether this is accurate or not, somebody once said President Trump is not president of the United States. He's president of his base. And that's who he plays toward. And to talk about the wall and militarizing the border and so forth is certainly to address concerns on the part of his base that he's not kept his promise in terms of putting the wall up. My concern as a political scientist is that you want to have good data. You want to have facts. And if the census is disrupted, that hurts us as social science.
And Dennis Goldford is professor of political science and department chair at Drake University. Also with us, Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. They'll stay with us for the second half of the program. We'll continue on with immigration. And also after the break, we'll look into how more women are getting involved, not just in running for political office, but for doing the behind-the-scenes work of running campaigns, a job long dominated by men. Ben Stanton here, back in a minute on Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Glad you're with us on this River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's Politics Wednesday, and with us for the remainder of the hour, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science and department chair at Drake University, and Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Well, we left off, we were talking about the Census Bureau. We're going to move on to immigration broadly. And on Tuesday, the Trump administration announced plans to deploy National Guard personnel to the southern border to prevent illegal crossings. The U.S. Homeland Security has reported illegal crossings and border arrests are at historic lows. But again, Trump made that announcement yesterday to enlist the military and border protection efforts at a luncheon with leaders of the Baltic states.
The laws that were created by Democrats are so pathetic and so weak. So I told Mexico, and I respect what they did, I said, look, your laws are very powerful. Your laws are very strong. We have very bad laws for our border. And we are going to be doing some things. I've been speaking with General Mattis. We're going to be doing things militarily. Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military. That's a big step. We really haven't done that before, or certainly not very much before. But we will be doing things with Mexico, and they have to do it. Otherwise, I'm not going to do the NAFTA deal. NAFTA's been fantastic for Mexico, bad for us.
Tim Hagel, this accomplished anything?
Well, as usual, it sows a little bit of confusion as far as what the specifics are. And so we've heard a number of White House officials try to clarify that in various ways. And essentially, having the military have a presence on our border isn't new in the sense that the Obama administration, the previous Bush administration have done similar sorts of things. The military can't be engaged in actual immigration activities, more advisory and things of that nature. They have certain limitations along this line, constitutional as well as statutory. But it does provide for freeing up a number of ICE agents to engage more in terms of the actual activities that would prevent people from coming across the border illegally. And partly this seems to be a reaction to stories that we've heard about a so-called caravan of people coming primarily from Honduras, something around an area of 1,000, 1,200 people, something like that. Although it seems like maybe that group has been broken up to a certain extent, that maybe Mexico is doing something. So there seem to be some conflicting reports as far as exactly what's going on at this point. But it's not something new either, that apparently there's often a long this time of the spring that there's an increase in border crossings. And so this may be a bit of a reaction, or some would probably say an overreaction to that. But again, it does fit in with the kinds of campaign themes that Trump has talked about for some time. And some people maybe more cynically are suggesting that this is just another attempt for Trump to talk to his base. And it is, but it's also a campaign promise that he talked about. And so in that regard, to the extent that there did seem to be this surge all of a sudden, even though, as you mentioned, that the numbers have been down, they are creeping up again. And this maybe is a reaction to this surge, particularly in light of concerns that he's expressed recently regarding MS-13 and other gang and drug-related problems.
Dennis Goldford.
Well, you know, I often use a phrase that I don't often hear the president use, and that phrase precedes a sentence. It's a dependent clause that says, if my information is correct. And if my information is correct, and one thing that I saw this morning was that the term caravan happened to pop up on Fox and Friends this morning or yesterday morning or sometime recently. And that seems to be where the president gets much of what he considers to be his information. Well, it's not always correct. It's not always accurate. And then, as Tim said, not to put words in Tim's mouth, you sometimes get this blizzard of ideas of what the president wants to do or intends to do, and the White House oftentimes has to clarify, well, here's exactly what he means by that. So immigration or illegal immigration seems to be at a multi-year low at the moment. Now, perhaps the Trump administration could take credit for that by saying they know we're not going to put up with them, so they're not coming. Others argue that illegal immigration flows depend more on the relative economies of the U.S. and Mexico than it does on anything else. I'm not an expert in that field. I don't know. But clearly, this is a case in which you have a policy issue that the president was concerned about or at least used as part of the central theme of his election campaign, whereas there's not a lot of other policy issues he did know much about. That's why, to some extent, he simply is the guy up there who's willing to sign more or less what comes up from the Republican-led Congress. But immigration has certainly been the Trump issue and the issue of greatest concern to the Trump base. And so this is a way of playing to that base and reinforcing his political support.
And the optics of it would think couldn't be hard for it not to benefit the president, showing that he's willing to do something to go towards one of those campaign promises and one of his signature issues, of course. So, what could go wrong for him? Tim Hagel.
Well, actually, I suppose a number of things could go wrong depending on how it all plays out, which is, I mean, there's nothing new about that, that whatever the issue happens to be, they're things, ways that it could work for any particular administration and work against any particular administration. And certainly that if you're talking about a number of the people that are in this group, call them a caravan or not, that there may be women and children. And, you know, I've seen people talking about, well, look, we don't have a moral duty to accept people from these other countries. On the other hand, some people would say, yes, we do, to a certain extent, if they can make it to the border and if they're here and if they're seeking asylum. And that's basically the key. And that concerns a number of people, is that the goal is, and maybe somewhat cynically, is that they come here and seek asylum, knowing that it would take, I figure I heard, was something like 700 days before they actually get a hearing. And by that point, they can be established and so forth in some particular way. And is that good? And that's the kind of thing that Trump has been complaining about, that basically people abusing the system, whether it's an asylum thing or otherwise. But again, the other side would say, but don't we have especially a moral duty once they're here to help them? We talked before about the constitutional side of things, where we have to have the privileges and immunities and whatever you want to call it, that once folks are here, that they have certain rights and we have certain moral obligations as well. And that's kind of the argument. And if that argument is successful, then it's the kind of a thing that can hurt the Trump administration, particularly if the Trump administration is successful in not allowing those people in. So it's not a clear-cut issue.
Politics Wednesday on River to River. Tim Hagel and Dennis Goldford with us. Well, women are running for office in record-breaking numbers in 2018. Increasingly, they're highlighting their gender as an issue in the campaign and taking on traditionally taboo topics. We have a little montage of ads from three female candidates running for governor and Congress this year.
There are no women in statewide or federal office in Maryland. None. This isn't just about representation. It's about policy. Some say no man can beat Larry Hogan. Well, I'm no man. I'm a mom, I'm a woman, and I want to be your next governor.
My art teacher asked why I was building a chest. I was 11, and I didn't tell anyone that a man living with us would come into my bedroom when I was asleep and lift my nightgown. Well, I fill that chest with the heaviest things that I could find, and I put it against that door to wake me up so I could fight him off. I'll fight as hard for you in Congress as I did to protect myself.
As a woman who's worked since I was 15 years old, I've dealt with handsy customers, with harassment, and even assault from a boss. The bullies have had their say. But if you join me in my campaign, they won't get the last word.
Excerpts there of ads from Krish Vignaraja, Democrat running for governor of Maryland, Saul Flores, a Democrat running for Congress in Illinois, and Mary Barzee Flores, Democrat running for Congress in Florida. Flores recently lost her primary bid for Congress in Illinois, but the other two women are still running primary campaigns. So is this a change in tone from women candidates? Dennis Goldford.
Well, again, we've got to beware of using terms too broadly. There's reference to women candidates in this regard, and women are angry. But don't forget, 53% of white women voted for President Trump. I've heard a new term. Tim may have heard this recently. People are talking about Roseanne voters in regard to the reappearance of the Roseanne show. I think that, to be sure, a lot of more liberal women don't like the president. They voted against this particular candidate, and they've decided to become more active in American politics. And there is a much larger number of women running for office, as well as managing campaigns. A lot of that is stimulated by the victory of Donald Trump and the onset of the Trump administration. But a lot of that is, to some extent, I should say it's accelerated by the presidency of Donald Trump. But a lot of that's been a development, has been coming along for a long time. There's a pipeline, for example. If you wonder why there haven't been many female candidates for governor or U.S. senator or U.S. Congress in various states, well, the pipeline takes a time to fill, and women have to start just as men did, running for lower levels of office. They get experience, and then they run for higher levels. The same is with regard to campaign management. You get more women getting involved at the grassroots level, and if they're successful, then they move up to higher level campaigns. So we're seeing the filling up of a pipeline that's got a long reach to it.
Tim Hagel.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's something I was thinking about earlier, too, is that I was thinking back, and I know a lot of folks, and I'm sure, Dennis, this is true, former students that have worked in political jobs as field operatives or whatever the particular term is, where they're working on ungodly hours and, you know, doing all of the grunt work for campaigns in terms of finding locations and signing up voters and walking neighborhoods. And at a certain point, then you sort of move up the ladder and they become the next job, and whether it's communications, and a number of women have had that job for years, so that's nothing new. But in terms of working up to those managerial types of positions, and we can think of folks that have had that in the past. I was trying to think of names. I think it was Susan Estrich years ago who had run, was it the Gore campaign?
If I remember, Dukakis
campaign. That was right. So you know, you've seen a few people along those lines, but now we're probably at the point where we're starting to see more, particularly at the congressional level, and we'll probably see it at higher levels too as people gain that kind of experience. And as far as the candidates too, now in terms of the tone and the issues that are raised, we've seen some of this before, and one of the things, of course, has to do with the Democrat versus Republican, that the Democrats tend to emphasize that a little bit more, have in the past, and we saw that in those clips that were played. With women running as Republicans, they maybe don't emphasize that as much as they would their resume, but occasionally, depending on the circumstances, that may be appropriate to bring out that type of issue, whether somebody has worked in the military, been a veteran of one sort or another, like our own Senator Joni Ernst, where she didn't push that too much, but it was basically a resume point and saying, well, look, you know, I can do this job. I understand what's going on. I understand the needs, and was emphasizing the veteran angle rather than necessarily the gender angle.
And some of the things we heard in those ads might relate to, you know, the Me Too movement, and something we generally see of as nonpartisan. Any connection there that this may be playing out, Dennis Goldfert?
Well, it's just Democrats have, I think, tried to do more because the Democrats have been more involved in identity politics with sometimes deleterious results. But nonetheless, Democrats have always pushed the idea of women as a discrete identity group more than Republicans have. But Republicans talk about merit independent of particular racial, ethnic, religious, and identities. But still, overall, we're seeing, as we've seen, just this change in the position of women in the country. I mean, on college campuses, I think 59% of college students, undergraduates, are female, only 41% male nationwide. It's roughly that, I think, at Drake, in fact, Drake University here in Des Moines. And, of course, the old days, it was overwhelmingly men. I recall that when I went to take in a big auditorium with hundreds of other people the graduate record exam to get into graduate school, I looked around. There were two female students there. I thought, why am I going to graduate school? And now it's very, very different. And in some ways, and I double-checked this with Catherine Perkins, there's a quote. Some listeners may remember the name Stokely Carmichael from the mid-1960s. He was head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And he was asked, what is the position of women in SNCC? And he said, the position of women in SNCC is prone. So there was a sexism even in the early civil rights movement, not so early, but in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, that helped to spark the women's movement itself. People who did not like that kind of sexism, even in the civil rights movement, which was done away with relatively quickly. And women have just, to sound horribly like an awful old cigarette commercial, women have come a long way, and we're seeing the further development of that, even if it's not where it needs to get to. We've seen a development of that extending now to the levels of campaign management.
Let's see if we can go to a caller. Suzanne is in Grinnell. Suzanne, go ahead. What are your thoughts?
Oh, hi, yes. I was just calling in about Joni Ernst, that she not only put veteran in there, but I believe she had three bullets in her signs, and I can't remember what the third one was, but one of them was mother, as I recall. And just regarding that last comment that was made about the 60s, I don't think that was done away with quickly. That's not my memory of the sexism in the left. So just want to make that clarification. And I just, you know, even a professor of mine who cringes now when he said, well, the women can be the secretaries in the in his, you know, I mean, this was common. You know,
oh, sure, sure. Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Suzanne.
It was there and, again, helped spark a lot of the women's movement. There were all sorts of other things, of course, that sparked the women's movement. But there was certainly a reaction to that comment, whether it was joking or not, from Stokely Carmichael. And as I said, women have come a great distance, but there's a lot more distance to go.
Very well. Well, let's move on here. We're rapidly running out of time, gentlemen, for the remainder of our program. But it looks like Special Counsel Robert Mueller is trying to get President Trump to sit down for an interview and relating that investigation to whether there's a collaboration with Russia. Mueller has said the president is a subject, not a target. There's been a lot of reporting about a clash among Trump's legal teams about whether such an interview would be a good idea, perhaps to clear his name, or whether it could, in fact, open the president up to making a mistake that could come back to bite him legally. And one of Trump's top personal lawyers last month, John Dowd, resigned. What is this latest information and mean to the investigation? And Tim Hagel, should the president sit down with Robert Mueller?
Well, there are mixed feelings about this. Certainly, there are a lot of people who would like him to, just to clear the air, Trump perhaps being one of them. But the advice that he was getting from a number of people, including the now no longer his attorney, Dowd, is the concern that Trump is not always careful in how he speaks. And we've talked about this already during the show in other contexts. And the concern is that he may be a little, shall we say, off the cuff in terms of how he phrases things. And when you're talking to the FBI or a special counsel, that's the kind of thing that can get you in trouble. And that's what a number of Trump advisors are worried about. Now, of course, he's dealt with courts and court cases and depositions and interviews of this sort before, but this is a little bit different because you've got somebody that's specifically looking for some crime that's happened. Collusion itself is not a crime, but whether it's some sort of activities with Russian people, and we've seen already that other people have gotten in trouble for, quote, lying to the FBI when they weren't entirely clear about what they were doing or what their activities were, what have you. And so that can perhaps be a problem, with what some people refer to as a perjury trap, where if you're not entirely sure and Mueller has or his team has more information than you do about what somebody else said, and then you get caught in a lie, that all of a sudden it's a big problem, especially if you're the president of the United States. And so for that reason, a lot of people say he shouldn't sit down. But if he doesn't, then other people are going to say, ah, what are you afraid of? And it's a political problem for him then.
Dennis Goldberg.
The president has tremendous confidence in his own persuasive powers. And this is what makes attorneys who by nature are cautious in terms of putting somebody on a stand or having somebody testify under oath. They're concerned about, as Tim said, whether what he might say would be consistent with other things he said. And that's why Dowd was trying to steer him away from this and felt that he wasn't being listened to and therefore resigned as the president's principal counsel.
Oh, and our president has a unique communication style, at least as far as recent presidents go, and perhaps his communication style in an interview like this could be a pitfall in itself.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we've seen this before, and we've sort of seen that there is a different style that he adopts when he's doing a flat-out campaign kind of thing, and he'll go off script and, you know, kind of engage in hyperbole and so forth. And then he can sometimes stay on script for certain types of things. And the big question is would he stay, so to speak, on script? Now, he's not going to have an actual script that he's going to read from if he sits down with Mueller or what have you. But the fact that he would have his attorneys basically rehearse, or, you know, you're going to be asked this, this is what you should say, you should limit your answer, don't expand on it. Would he be able to do that? And what, you know, Ben, what you were just saying is that he has a particular style, and his style, particular style, isn't to be more circumspect in his communications.
And very quickly, before we end our program, the president and Russian President Vladimir Putin have discussed possibly getting together for an in-person meeting. A Russian aide told foreign news outlets that Trump had extended an invitation in just 30 seconds each or so. Tim Hagel, a good idea?
It's not a bad idea. I mean, obviously, there are certain problems just because of who it is, but you want to get along with even competitors in the world market if they're leaders.
Dennis Goldberg.
meeting might not be a bad idea, but it's a shame it's not a more neutral spot. Being invited to the White House is a mark of high respect, and it's a kind of reward for your friends and allies. And so to do this in the White House confers a certain status on someone like Mr. Putin or anybody that might be different if they met somewhere else, not in either one's home base, so to speak.
Very good. Well, we're out of time for our program today. Thank you, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science and department chair at Drake University. Thanks for being here today, as always.
It's a pleasure.
And Tim Hagel, thank you, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa.
Good to be with you.
Well, River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon, with assistance today from Natalia Reyes. Executive producer of talk shows is Catherine Perkins. We want to hear your feedback and ideas for upcoming shows. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Well, River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.